Checking in with State Representative Techie Chan of Quincy for another Friday Techie Talk. How you doing, Techie?
Hey, Joe, it's great. It's a little bit nippy today, hence I have a little extra outerwear inside my house.
Yes, you're looking very formal for our talk today. That's kind of nice, actually.
Yeah, I mean, a little casual, no tie, but I'll do that for a change of pace for the audience.
Folks I've talked to are very concerned about you, Jackie. They want to make sure you're okay because I know you're hunkering down due to the health conditions of your mom.
Yeah, no, I appreciate people's concerns. I have people who are actually checking in by text every so often to make sure I have signs of life. And I am still avoiding people. You're right. And we're heading towards winter. Those who've dealt with me during the winter months into spring months know that I'm not always in the best of health. I got bronchitis at a drop of a hat. It's been a recurring theme my life since I was about 30 years old. So additional stress levels does cause health issues and whatnot. But I've been getting a little more to the stores. I've trying to take advantage of every warm weather I can to get for walks in the neighborhood. I'm trying to exercise, obviously, and I have an old exercise bike I got to get out and dust off for this winter. So I'm trying, but I appreciate everyone's concerns. And no, you will not be seeing me too often.
Sure. Well, especially now, a lot of health experts are a little bit concerned about the uptick in coronavirus cases, not only here in Quincy, but across the state.
Yeah, we are definitely on the front side of wave two. I mean, we're at the bottom of that curve going up. The numbers have been fluctuating, but they've been consistently over 400. The death count, sadly, the death count still shows above 10. It looks closer to above 15 the past several weeks. Hospitalizations are up, which is troubling, closing in on 100 more hospitalizations than 7 days ago. And ICU is up as well. And I really do not want this to become a norm in our lives, that we've accepted infection rates of hundreds and death rates of tens and hopefully not hundreds down the road. We still have to be extraordinarily vigilant. And that this is the last thing I want, is that this is considered our norm, watching hospitalizations, infections, and death counts every night. This is across the news. And I continue to receive briefings from the governor once to twice a week, plus our own inquiries in the middle of the week about the status of COVID-19. So again, the emergency orders in place for the governor: wear your mask, keep your social distance. Even social distance, wear your mask as a precaution, wash your hands, be very conscious of things you touch and rub against. And most often and most importantly, be mindful of others around you, because even though you may be feeling well or you may have very, very, very mild symptoms, you are still a carrier, and it's entirely possible you could infect. And as we've seen, unfortunately, last week, it doesn't matter who you are, what position you are, what race you are, how much money you have, or what your title is. This is a disease that doesn't care about any of that stuff, and you will get it.
Do you think that the relaxing of some of the occupancy rules are troubling? Do you think maybe there's a rollback in our future?
Really depends on how we behave, right? As I've repeated multiple times, and I'll do so again, that the rollback and our growth of our economy in terms of whether we shut down or we keep going is dependent on us. If we behave well and we're very conscious about our health situation and we stay vigilant, we will not need to shut things down. And I do understand the economy will be impacted because we are behaving in a very conscientious manner about how we interact with other people and not allow ourselves to become sick nor transmit the disease ourselves if we are sick. So things like getting a flu shot is becoming imperative. If you're a family with a newborn, getting your immunizations for your child is imperative. If you are unwell, it is imperative that you make a decision to not go to work, limit your contacts, and limit your contacts with your family the best possible in your household. So, it's actually up to us to practice good hygiene and healthcare. And I do know there are essential things we all have to do, and if you have to do it, wear a mask and bring your hand sanitizer and keep your distance and just do your best to make it work. And thankfully, we're in a great society of friends and neighbors. So if you need help something, I mean, I always call my next door neighbor and they're more than happy to do something for me. And if it's a drop off, they'll leave it at my front steps and walk away and text me that it's there. Been very lucky in that sense too. So don't be afraid to ask for help. We're a very generous society. I can't see why anybody wouldn't help you out.
Let's talk a little bit about the economic impacts and how it pertains to the state budget. I know you've had discussions just earlier this week about that.
Yeah, last April when we had this conversation, the number we're looking at was $6 billion in the hole for FY21 budget. That would have been a $6 billion off a $31 billion projected forecast for income taxes in the state, plus fees and all the other types of taxes. That was a kind of starting number almost 6 years ago. I mean, that feels like 6 years ago. April was a kind of a starting point, and that would be catastrophic because that's 18% of the revenue, and you know, off a $40 billion budget, that's a lot of money. Well, the experts continue to be baffled exactly where we're heading. FY20 showed a shortfall of about $693 million because of delay of taxes, as well as, you know, late tax filings are going to continue straight to October 15th because people got delayed to then. And certain things weren't very good. Meals tax was not good, for obvious reasons. Use tax was not as good. People weren't buying cars. Gas tax, no one was driving. So we took serious hits on all those fronts on tax revenue in FY20, and those tax hits will continue in FY21 because of our change of lifestyle. But we think we've done a good job this summertime using various federal COVID monies that the budget hope for FY20 represents 0.76%-ish or something like that loss. But I think we can figure out how to close that pretty well when we close the books this month. FY21, the experts are ranging everywhere from a 4.1% or to a 12.4% revenue loss. So that can be anywhere between 2.7 and 5.3 billion. Some very optimistic outlooks is closer to $1.9 billion loss. Some very grim outlooks put as closer to $5.5 billion loss, depending on which organization you talk to. So the experts, again, are unable to give us a ballpark number where they all seem to be within the same field. Right now, we got someone sitting at home plate and some way in right field, and something in the middle is the number. We prefer it if you're somewhere inside the baseball diamond. So if everyone has a different opinion, at least you're inside the diamond, we have an idea what's happening. The GDP has been a miserable, no surprise, in Massachusetts. We had a 31.6 decline in GDP in the month, in the second quarter, which would be in the summer months. Unemployment rates 11.6% as of August. Phase 3 reopening has reduced us from 17% to 11.3%. We're still among the highest in the nation. Unemployment Rhode Island next door is 12, which is, once again, I mean, 11 or 12 at this stage. It's significant either way. We are running behind the national average on unemployment, which is better. But then again, as you see in the news, not all states are doing the same things we're doing and trying to contain the virus and behave a little better. Capital gains revenue is another problem. Home transactions were slow. They've obviously very much picked up the past month or so, but second quarter was not good, as well as the volatile market. I know stock market's up, but it's been a roller coaster ride. So people paying capital gains has been also following the roller coaster ride. So it's down 27% plus on capital gains. Meals tax declines over 33% loss. That doesn't include the hotel taxes. So, you know, it's been extraordinarily significant. Some forecast by the big banks, you know, Moody's and Morgan and those guys, has the United States GDP recovery happening in FY 2022 in a best case scenario. Worst case scenario, US GDP will recover in 2024. Massachusetts is looking to be behind the rest of the nation on that, largely because of our economy is driven by the education system, higher education, tourism, and healthcare. And people go, well, healthcare is doing well because of COVID-19. Well, healthcare isn't doing well because they're not getting optional services. So a lot of people who need non-critical life-saving services are not receiving them because of COVID-19 preparation. And insurance companies aren't paying for COVID-19 preparation, the state is. So we're actually in a very interesting budgetary issue. Whether we like it or not, the government does not prepare for finances in the future. We're about paying things now for services now. People want things today. They don't want to wait to next year. So unlike other methods, we're actually spending money in preparation for something that we hope doesn't happen. So using COVID money, Medicare money, we've been continuing to maintain readiness at the hospital level, community center level, and you know, field hospitals ready to go if we need to. There'd be no setup time, would be very quick, but that costs money. And this is money taxpayers are not going to see immediate benefit from. If there's no massive second wave, we spend money that was never going to be used because there was no second wave. Conversely, if a second wave come, we're prepared. And this is a real budgetary problem for us that we've never really had to face. So taxpayers are going to be somewhat unhappy in the sense that, well, it seems like we wasted money because something bad didn't happen and we don't want something bad to happen. But at the same time, we didn't spend the money now in preparation. The tragedy would be catastrophic.
Well, I mean, you know, equated to homeowners insurance, right? And something you pay for years and years and years and hope you never have to use. But do you call that wasted money or do you call that, you know, peace of mind and money well spent?
Well, this is a good question. It depends. It seems like this has become an ideological issue with people in politics and rather a practical issue about saving lives. And this is kind of the trouble of the country we're in today about that, where people have these philosophies about what the priorities are. And I do share some of these philosophies about, you know, saving lives, keeping our economy going, trying to save our livelihoods. I don't disagree with any of that. But you know, when you get to a real hard choice in government, whose job includes trying to protect people, not necessarily from just crime, now we're trying to protect you from a disease. You know, it's ultimately on, you know, our heads what happens next. And I'm sure the governor, as you see on television, still suffers a whole lot of restless nights. And I won't lie, I've had my share of restless nights as well, worrying about, you know, everyone in assisted living facilities, everyone living in nursing homes, everybody I know living in senior housing. People I know that have been compromised, that I've met and had the pleasure of spending time with throughout my life in Quincy, not just as an elected official. So, you know, these are things that we have to consider. So, I mean, it's a very difficult budgeting process. We're going to have some mini caucuses coming up soon. Actually, my caucus comes up next Thursday to discuss big ticket items. Do not expect a whole lot of so-called pork coming home in terms of earmarks and special money to different things. We're going to probably try to do largely a budget designed around big ticket items. And even then, there's a lot of those ticket items that are going to be challenging to meet. And local aid's one of them. The lottery has reported decline in sales this year. Keno has taken a strong hit. Thankfully, for better or for worse, we're a scratch ticket state, which basically held up the lottery system, but multi-state and numbers games were very severely impacted because people can go buy tickets in the convenience stores. And when the supermarket, you're not waiting in line to get a lottery ticket these days. People are moving through. But, you know, instant tickets are faster to get with instant ticket machines. So people, for better or for worse, have been sustained the lottery through the COVID period through instant tickets. So the lottery only came in at $986 million-ish in profit, which is still very substantial. That goes to local cities and towns, but they're projecting for FY21, $940 million. To put it in perspective, last cycle, fiscal year, the budget was at record highs, just over $1 billion in net profit. So, you know, as the economy kind of tries to recover, people are hoping for more assistance from the feds. You know, we have those factors as well. Unemployment is taxable, so let you all know your unemployment benefits is taxable. That is something that's going to be factored into future budget revenues. And so far, the statistics have shown that the end of the $600 extra money for unemployment by the federal government has not changed unemployment much as part of reopening. There's this kind of story going around that people are not going back to work because unemployment plays more than going back to work. I'm not saying that's not true. It is true. But in the big picture statistics, that's the outlier, not the mainstream. So there is no sign that the elimination or, sorry, the ending of that benefit has caused a massive spike in employment. It's pretty much stayed at steady rate since then, reflecting the phase openings. So
Steve,
we are.
Yeah, the one word to describe it all sounds like is unpredictable. So you need to prepare for a variety of different scenarios in the budget, it sounds like.
Yeah, we have a $3.5 billion rainy day fund we can spend, but we're going to have to look spending it over at least three fiscal cycles. If it would be imprudent of us to spend all $3.5 billion in 1 year, and in FY22 continues to be challenging, we really need to have some savings to buffer against the closing hole. But since we don't even know what the hole looks like, we have no idea. And the president's tweets about we're not doing economic stimulus, the markets fall. And the next day he says, oh, you should all get back to the table with economic stimulus. It's causing a whole lot of consternation at my level. I'm willing to take anything the feds give us. So, you know, I'm not sitting here saying, should give me $5 billion or $1 billion. Just give us something.
Yeah.
And then we can do something with it.
Can we talk a little bit, Jackie, about the moratorium on evictions that's set to expire next week, actually, here at the state level, and the action that might be taken in the legislature to change that or extend that?
Yeah, there's a bill in the works that left the Committee of Housing favorably and sitting in Ways and Means to extend the moratorium period to 1 year after the end of the pandemic. This is challenging for us because housing is an essential part of not just life, but also our ability to create stable life for people to be able to have a place to sleep and a roof over their heads so they can go about their business, get work done and pay rent and so forth and buy goods and services and everything else. But housing has always been my belief is the baseline people need to survive, and not just practical matter, but also psychologically. It'd be interesting to see how this goes because at the end of the extra money from the federal government, unemployment benefits are now two-thirds or capped at median household income, two-thirds out there, and you're not going to have enough money to pay for your rent. Now, people that I know have gone back to work, particularly gig employees, contractors, and people who are in high contact with other folks are not seeing the volume of people they worked before. So they're making money, but they're not making the money they were making before. On the flip side, I fully understand that landlords do have mortgages to pay. They have utilities paid, they have upkeeps to pay. And it's not just residential, it's also commercial businesses have that as well. We learned that the hotels, for example, do bulk pooled, it's basically pooled mortgages where multiple hotels put the collateral on the line for better rates on a shared mortgage situation. And The federal government needs to figure out how to manage that as projection hotel industry in Massachusetts is going to be like, I think 40% of them are recurring closed. We don't know how many can be permanently closed. And there goes a lot of money there for the landlords and the banks. So it is a very difficult struggle on this policy matter. I do recognize that landlords have to pay property taxes. That's part of it as well. So if they aren't receiving any income, how are they going to make those payments? And, the city puts a lien on the property. That doesn't help the tenant either.
Right.
So I'm not sure where is the right answer following this one. I've had advocates come talk to us at all levels. But there needs to be a sensitivity that we are all in this together. And not surprising, it's become us versus them again regarding certain issues. And I wish there was an easy answer for any of this stuff that I know. And I do understand there are bad tenants, and I do understand there are bad landlords. I do understand that there are both tenants and landlords who abuse the system. I get that. And that's just some good people trying to do the right thing, but found themselves in a very bad situation.
Yeah, it'll have long-lasting impacts on affordable housing in general, because if these landlords are forced to either sell their properties or lose them because of taxes, that just takes that housing stock off the market.
And the banks do not like to own housing.
Right.
If everyone from the holy foreclosure crisis, banks, empty property owned by banks lead to problems in a neighborhood. If you live next to an abandoned property because of a foreclosure situation, you know what I'm talking about. So, I really don't know what the answer is, to be honest with you.
Yeah. What can we learn about this from other countries that have gone through the same thing?
Countries like England, for example, and actually quite a few European countries have basically paid employers to keep employees on payroll, even though they're not doing any work.
Okay.
So much like the payroll protection program, except it's a little different. unlike the Payroll Protection Program, which has conditions regarding converting it from a loan to a grant, European countries have adopted a position, we're just going to pay you straight up to maintain your operating cost, and they're just going to absorb the deficit. These are smaller countries. The GDP are smaller than us, but they're also borrowing deficit rate is very high as well against the GDP. Mm-hmm. Some other countries that have undergone shutdowns have done direct and continued payments to residents. Hong Kong is going into its cash reserve and just paying its residents extra money, very much like $1,200 the Fed's provided, but substantially more in relationship to the cost of living. And you look at some other countries like Japan and others, they've not done direct things like rental relief or payroll protection, but have also provided direct stimulus money directly to the people in terms of cash payments to people, and then try to provide some technical assistance programs for their businesses. Other countries like New Zealand hasn't really done any real changes because they were locked down so hard in their tourism-driven business and such a small economy. Mm-hmm. You know, Australia has been doing pocket-to-pocket because their spike rates are occurring in certain provinces. I know that they, again, also on a federal level to look at direct payment and payroll assistance relief. No one's really cutting taxes worldwide. It's more about government spending more money directly into the residents or their businesses to do that. China, for example, has not spent money into the businesses. Instead, they provide, this is interesting, government paid for coupons to buy things from businesses.
Yeah.
There's a concern in that country culturally that if you give cash payments to the residents, they won't spend their money, they'll hoard your money.
I see.
So it's a cultural issue. So the belief is that if I give you $1,000, you're never going to put it back in the economy, you're just going to save it. So instead, they provide a coupon system. The trouble with the coupon system is winners and losers. It's unlike giving you cash, you can choose your business to infuse the economy. Right. If I give you coupons, then certain businesses won't receive the benefit of infusion. So they give you an idea of another different way of approaching the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, $1,200 had an impact. That $600 from the unemployment benefit had an impact. It's ensured that our commercial economy was moving.
Yeah.
So everyone's struggling the same way we are. And, you know, every country is going to start deficit spending.
One country, you know, we have not heard a lot about, and I was just curious about it, was Canada. We haven't heard much about how the virus is impacting Canada or their healthcare system, which is much different, or their economy. I just have not heard a lot of news coming out of our neighbors to the north.
Well, heck, you're in luck. We did the monthly Zoom call now that we're doing with my mom's side of the family, and my uncle's a doctor in Canada. Oh. So, one of the topics of the conversation. Exactly. You can't avoid talking about COVID no matter how much you try. He lives in the Toronto area, and COVID counts in Toronto and Ottawa up. They've reached triple digits. They're staring at a second wave. Mm-hmm. For those who aren't aware, Canada closed the border to us, not the other way around.
Right.
And they have imposed strict travel restrictions, just like us and all the other countries, to other places that are COVID positive, heavily COVID positive. So winter is coming for them, and Canada's winters are more severe than here, and they have a national healthcare system, which is under stress, but still okay. That is one of the priorities of actually every country's healthcare system. It doesn't matter if it's private or public, to try to not to overtax the healthcare system. So while we're not getting a whole lot of news, my uncle tells me it counts it up. He's a senior citizen doc. He still works, but they really are limiting their movement still in that country and hope to keep the infection rate stable, but that's not the case now. So as winter's coming for them in a much more severe manner, and they're going to be indoors, and the flu comes as well as respiratory diseases and other things that come with winter months. They're telling me that they're probably staring it down at the second wave, about probably close to when we hit in Massachusetts if the numbers stay steady.
Mm.
And yeah, we could be seeing some drastic action by the provincial governments, because the federal government is – Canada's a weird government. The provincial government is actually stronger than the federal government. So you're going to see a lot of provincial governments taking actions once the counts hit a certain number.
Yeah, the populations are so concentrated up there. You know, the vast amount of the country is unpopulated, so it's the cities that really are going to feel the effects, I'm sure.
Yeah, everything along the border of the United States is populated. You know, Quebec, Ottawa, Toronto, the major population centers on the east side, Vancouver, is the huge population on the West Coast. Winnipeg is in the middle. They're super concentrated, but the burbs in Canada are very stretched. Canadian housing always baffles me because it's all manufactured housing. I'm used to, you know, the diversity of housing where I live. Everybody's different, but over there right. It's manufactured. But it's close quartered manufactured. It means, you know, it's a community built neighborhood where it's all relatively similar housing, but they're also all sparse, close together. Mm-hmm. So, it'd be interesting to see how this plays out there and hoping for the best. Meanwhile, our neighbors to the south in Mexico and Central America and so forth continue to be, ravaged by this wave of COVID. And there's not been a lot of news out of there lately because, you know, we've been obsessed with what's going on in the United States news, but things have not really changed there. I still think like states like Florida are still in wave one. They're not in wave two. Wave two only comes if you have shown demonstratively a decline in infection rates for a steady period, that it appears that you're moving in the right direction and perhaps stabilizing and then rising again. They've never stabilized. You can't call that a wave two. India is still in wave one. India has 4 million, well over 4 million infected. They're likely going to surpass the United States sometime in the next 3 months if they continue the pace they're going at. And that's the next country to watch for a very high death count. And the statistics may be off because of the healthcare system's ability to manage that, and the reporting from the healthcare system is very strained. And, you know, even in the United States, you know, there probably been COVID deaths and infections unreported because of people dying at home, people dying suddenly that didn't quite have a chance to check out what's going on at the very beginning of the wave. So, you know, the numbers are always going to be a little bit off because of those factors. But yeah, well, globally speaking, it's still going to be very ugly.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about post-pandemic, I guess. How long do you think after a viable vaccine is developed and started to be administered that economies will start to rebound?
It comes down to who gets it first, right? So the vaccines driven by who can afford to get it first to immunization their population at the level that reaches herd immunity. And it really requires the speed. We talked a little bit last about supply chain issues and who gets it first, rich countries versus poor countries, senior citizens and immune compromise gets it first, or, you know, what if we do with children? I mean, it becomes a real policy and logistical question for people above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. But they're real important questions to ask. And certain economies like China, for example, have gone back super insular because they've limited travel, very limited travel from outsiders, instead of infection rates locally. But they're trying to drive their economy strictly through their size of population and just move it that way. And they're going to find it's going to be very hard because they're still manufacturing. But if other economies can't buy, then your manufacturing becomes irrelevant.
Right.
So there's that factor there. Depending on who you ask, I mean, it could take a full year to two for us to recover, even post second and hopefully no third wave, and with vaccinations, because it takes time for everybody to get up to speed. You got to have a program to identify travelers that are COVID vaccinated globally. We're still a global economy. I know people hate the word globalization sometimes, but we're a global economy, and you're feeling it now because we have no tourists. We have no students. We have no international travelers coming in for healthcare. Conversely, we're not going anywhere either. We're not traveling to Europe. We're not traveling to Asia. We're not traveling to Mexico or Canada. Their economy is impacted by us. And we're the world's largest economy with the highest per capita in the world. So when we travel, we bring money. Mm-hmm. That's an adverse effect as well.
Yeah.
So, that's part of globalization. So the question really becomes in my mind, not just necessarily the vaccine and we're able to get our feet up, how quickly, you know, consumer confidence will recover. I mean, we're all still floating well under 100% consumer confidence. How quickly we are able to adapt to a new norm, because we have adapted to a new norm, and how much this new norm continues. And also changing economies. I mean, every time there's an economic shift, professions change or professions go away or new ones emerge. Mm-hmm. What's that going to become? And whether we're going to accept, you know, we got to have to accept the fact that it's the world's largest economy and, you know, the world's last and only superpower. No, we're going to have to drive the world economy. And is the American public willing to understand that, you know, the U.S. government's going to have to spend and invest in foreign nations? We're going to ourselves have to spend and invest. by traveling and spending much domestically, but also our neighboring states and you know, come out of a bubble, go elsewhere, but also maintain these healthcare precautions in case, you know, this thing mutates, you know, 5 years down the road and something special comes back and bites us again. So, I mean, there's a lot of ifs, but, I think it'll take probably a year, possibly two, you know, if we hit herd immunity vaccine for that to recover. And the things we're living now, like we're doing now, I mean, we probably should continue to do this. I mean, one of the things that worked out really well for my committee as a chair was holding weekly meetings in this format. It's more easier for me to bring guest speakers in to talk to my committee members. Actually, in a small group, very controlled, we're able to do controlled conversation. And even for you and me, scheduling has been much easier than me and poor Mark, which I haven't seen in person or talked to since March, because we don't have to sandwich in travel time for me.
Right, so the convenience factor is you know, unmistakable for certain. And as the bad weather starts to approach, it's going to be even, you know, that more convenient.
Exactly, and that's part of it too. Are we going to accept living this type of lifestyle? And I think some of it's great. Some of it still makes me crazy. I'd rather be in the studio with you. There's a certain personal touch and conversation.
I agree.
That's lost. But at the same time, though, yeah, I very much, as you guys all know, I enjoy doing this. It's less about my desire to come and more my ability to schedule, my ability to get from A to B to C and get you there in time of, you know, or causing an accident as I'm rushing from place to place.
Yes, we don't want that.
No.
Let's bring it down locally. As I'm sure you're familiar, this week the city here in Quincy decided to waive the liquor license renewal fees for restaurants for next year, to just give them a little bit of help. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, it only helps certain restaurants that have alcohol licenses. As I remind folks, the vast majority of restaurants do not have liquor licenses. I've talked to the restaurant industries and a couple of consultants in the industry. Out of 16,000 restaurants in the Restaurant Association, 3,400 closed, probably permanently. We saw them use Kinsale Close, which is near the State House, very much an anchor spot for students and workers. The survey from the Mass Restaurant Association shows that of their membership, 40% do not believe they're going to survive 6 months.
Wow.
If something doesn't change, whether we get a vaccine or people need to behave. I mean, this is the emphasis in the restaurants, that people need to behave. And restaurants will make the effort to do everything they can to keep you safe, but do not go to the restaurant if you're sick. It's just going to hurt their business. Do takeout, please. So 40% believe that if people don't change and there's no vaccine, they're going to be out of business. 46% believe that if they don't see PPP, Payroll Protection Program, in some form for the feds, they'll be out of business sometime after the year turns. Mm. So this is dire, folks. This is legitimately dire. So the waiving of licensing fees at the local level, Quincy, I'm sure other communities are following suit. Provide some help for only the restaurants with alcohol licenses, not right. For those that don't.
Okay.
The city, you know, could waive business licensing fees if they so desire, or change the business licensing structure. That's up to them. At my level, I filed a bill to allow restaurants with liquor licenses to be able to hold on to licenses for a time they're closed, because an unused license actually reverts back to the city or town. So some states have already moved forward on trying to figure out how to allow a business during this type of state of emergency to hold on to the license while they're not open.
Yes.
So we have legislation filed. We're going to have more conversations at the committee level as well as the industry about the practicalities of making this work not result in a massive flood of licenses returning to this city. Some statistics we got on alcohol licenses for restaurants and retail, about 20% of all licenses, I think, in Boston's been returned to Boston. City like Holyoke is up to 60% of all licenses have returned to the city.
Wow.
And this is actually, you're like, okay, what does that mean? Well, it means that those businesses that are alcohol driven are now out of business. And you're like a city of Holyoke, and you got 60% license returned to the city. That means that 60% of the business that have alcohol as part of their part of the business structure is now permanently closed.
And their employees are out of work.
Yeah, that's what that means. It's an odd survey to look at, but it gives me a window into what's going on around the state. And they said Boston's at 20%. I fully expect Boston to be at 30% by the end of the time. And if we don't put together this bill on, if we don't put a law together on allowing to hold on your license while you're closed, for a period. So, it's, you know, the Lodging Association, like I said, half their hotels are closed, but 40% and half are closed. Nationally, you know, they're looking at equally sized percentage. Internationally, also equally sized percentage. And they have a lot of ripple impact. Some of the members of the Lodging Association is part of Restaurant Association because they cross-pollinate. Some of the hotels in the Restaurant Association say they're about 88% furloughed. That's a lot of folks.
I mean, normally those licenses would just turn over, right? There'd be new ones applying to open up new restaurants and new hotels. But I don't think there's a lot of new restaurants and hotels opening right now.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And that's what happens. People buy a license to transfer at a market rate cost, which in Boston is between $400,000 to $600,000, so about $400,000 minimum in Boston. And that valuation is reduced to $200,000. And I'm suspecting it's going to be a $150,000 valuation by the time Christmas hits. Mm-hmm. So imagine you bought a license for $500,000 in January and opening your restaurant. And come December, your license valuation is down to $150,000. And you're struggling because you have to make your rent to your landlord. You have employees that you don't want to let go, but you're going to have to. Your supply chain's a problem because you still have to, you have all that booze and food that's going to waste, that someone's been given away and some, brought it. And, even the beer stuff, beer is perishable. Bad beer, no one wants to buy bad beer. It stinks. But, I mean, the beer distributing industry, the distributors, the guys that bring the trucks and crotch your beer, they tell us they had to recall kegs of beer from all over the place and destroy it, costing them tens and tens of millions of dollars for proper destruction of beer. Which then they had to get money back from the supplier, which is actually harder than the retailer or the end user trying to get back from the distributor.
Right.
So, this is the supply chain issue. End user has an impact on the supply and the distribution, same as way supply and distribution has an impact on the end user.
Yeah.
It'll be tough.
Does the fact that online sales are now subject to the state sales tax help?
It helps, but it's also transferability issues, right? People are really reducing themselves to buying essential goods and services.
Yeah.
So, according to The Economist, food is up. It's one of the few things that we're spending more money on.
Mm-hmm.
Recreation's down by 26 to 30%. Fuel is down like 5%. Other aspects of the economy is moving the other way in terms of usage. Moving upbound on essential supplies, those are up. Buying wood is very hard. People spent the summer doing home projects.
Yes.
Barbecue grills are very hard to get. I got a fire pit. I never, ever thought I'd ever get a fire pit. But it gives us something to do in the yard and a social distancing for maybe two or three people, 8 feet apart from each other around a fire pit. Because fire pit has the zone to determine distance among all of us, so to speak. Yes and no. It sales tax does help us there, but overall, with people, high unemployment rate, people not having money, extra money to spend, people spending on essential services, essential goods now, we're not seeing that. We're not going to see that big benefit in terms of online sales.
Let's do our weekly census update and spin the census deadline wheel and see what date comes up this time, Jackie. Every time we talk, we say the deadline to respond to the federal census is such and such, and every time we recap, it's changed.
Yeah, it's always good when I'm giving you bad information because they change it on me the day after I give it to you. it's part of the struggle of this situation of me trying to make sure I give you the best information possible, and then by the time I talk to you next week, it's not the same thing. The census deadline is on October 31st. So those who are wondering, initially the deadline was supposed to be at the beginning of September.
Right.
Then because of COVID, they pushed it out to October 31st. Then they decided that, well, we need to shut our doors sooner, so we're going back to September 1st. And then they decide that a judge ruled that they had to keep it open to system October 31st. Then they pushed it off to October 5th in response to the federal judge. And then just this week, they decided to go back to October 31st. So census people are still going to be out making phone calls, knocking on doors, and you can still fill in the census form on your own as we speak right now to October 31st at 2020census.gov. And interestingly, because of this extension, nationally, there's been a small uptick in response rates, you know, 66.7. Last time I talked to you was 66.6. So people are still self-responding, which is an incredibly positive sign. Massachusetts is 69.1% responding on people on their own. Quincy has now exceeded the Massachusetts average.
Hey,
69.3% of the population is now reporting on their own. Last week, we were dead on center of the Massachusetts average. So amazing how a week makes in terms of people taking their own initiative with filling the census. Weymouth is at 74.8, Braintree at 79.3, Randolph at 71.2, Milton at 82.6, Holbrook at 75.7, Norfolk County is the best reporting county at 75.4%. So the extension of just 1 week has actually created enormous shift in more self-reporting. Self-reporting means no phone call from the census, and self-reporting means that you will not have someone knock on your door. Again, in this COVID situation, we would like to have not anyone knock on your door.
Right.
But you know, enumerated-wise, Massachusetts is closing in about 99.9% complete in terms of enumerated, which is that the phone calls and the door knockers. But, you know, that's still not 100%. So please, you know, 2020census.gov, your mail-in ballots, if you ask for mail-in ballot phone numbers, should be coming in the mail next week. Today's Friday, the 9th? Today's the 9th, so your mail-in ballots are coming next week. You still have time to register to vote. Information is on my website, my Facebook at Tacky Chan, State Representative Tacky Chan, City Clerk's Office, Secretary of State's Office, Where Do I Vote MA, any campaign website you find out there of a candidate. You can still register to vote and get in your mail-in ballot, and mail-in ballots are on the way. So, you're looking to do a mail-in ballot in October, please remember to fill out the census as part of your, let's make sure we get to 100,000 plus people in Quincy because it changes our HUD formula. And every person counts to ensure that we're properly represented. And so, as I will say again, it's the only time that every person is properly represented as countries, the U.S. Census, regardless of your legal status, your education, your race, creed, color, religion. It doesn't matter. This is the one time where everyone is truly representing the United States.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Tacky. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Joe. We're going to see you again next week because, you know, same bad time, same bad channel. yes, I'm old enough to know that one. But be well, you know, be safe. We'll do this again soon.
Sounds good. All right. Take care.